Welcome to Food Conversation Season 3. Food Conversation is a program about everything to do with food, starting with planting seeds or growing little animals, and then growing, harvesting, distributing, and of course, eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Before we continue, I would like to acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmek people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Now, today I'm delighted to welcome to our show our first, but definitely not our last, Indigenous food expert, Chef Garrett McKill, owner-operator of the Tsukolten Products Food Emporium. Welcome, Garrett, to Food Conversations.
Thanks, Warren.
Delighted to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Now, you'll soon learn that Garrett is a human dynamo, as you'll learn as we go along, and he's also a proud member of the Tsukolten Nation. Now, we're going to get into that very important part of Garrett's life in a few minutes, but let's begin, as we all do in this world, at the beginning. And Garrett, born and raised in Williams Lake, the youngest of three with two older sisters. Now, as soon as you told me that, I knew you had to have been spoiled. You had to be a number one in some senses in the family circle. Was I right?
I like to call it the family favorite, but doesn't, nothing's in writing or set in stone. But in my mind, that's how it goes, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a good place to be. It just doesn't happen to everybody.
That's right.
And the first part of your life was like one giant sports activity. As far as I can tell, you played every sport that was available in Williams Lake and maybe a few that weren't. What was that like, being like a serious jock from the get-go? I mean, it must have been, you were running around a lot.
I don't know if I'd call it a serious jock, but yeah, I did dabble in a lot of different sports over the years, and I kind of had something for every season. Some seasons doubled up, and it got to a point in life where I had to make a choice between one or the other, and had to kick soccer to the curb and went to baseball full-time.
You really did go to baseball full time. You got to the point where there were scouts coming up from the Blue Jays having a look at your fastball. What was that like, having Williams Lake scouts from the Blue Jays? Must have had a little bit of an impact on you.
Yeah, it was. It was kind of exciting. I was always one that liked the pressure of that kind of thing sitting lingering over your head, I guess, in a sense. I started out in Williams Lake. When I was 15, I moved down to Kamloops for the season and played for their team down there. They had invited me down the summer prior. We played them and really got our butts kicked, to say the least. But the coach was impressed with my pitching, so he invited me to come down. And I said if I could bring my own back catcher with me, so I had a friend with me to go to school and stuff, I would come. And I ended up moving down to my cousin's place and living there for the season and played down there to try and open up my my box a little bit more and get me a little further out there.
That was a pretty smart move, having somebody come with you that was, somebody you knew. I mean, not everybody's got that kind of brain to think that, hey, it's good to have somebody around that you know.
Well, we were going into a new school, and we actually didn't go there until halfway through the school year. Right. So, I mean, a lot of people out there know what it's like to be the new kid in the block, right? It's not always the most pleasant, so it's nice to take a familiar face with you and try and ease that pain a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Then somewhere around 19, you headed off in a different direction as the motor vehicle world caught your interest.
Yes, I started to have to work and to pay for, the extracurricular activities in the vehicles over the years, for sure. Between destroying them and, just
enjoying
the things that come with life at certain times. It got to be fairly expensive. So I had to go to the world of work, unfortunately. And like I said before, no regrets in life, but that's just kind of the way I got steered at the time.
Yeah, I was totally impressed by the fact that you you figured out you'd probably had about 24 cars in your time. And
I think I'm on about 23 or 24 now, yeah.
well, I've had five, and I've lived about more than twice as long on this planet. So I'm impressed. Okay, I'm impressed. I had a Morris Minor. Can you believe it? I won't talk any more about that. Enough of my cars. So your dad worked for the city, and your mom worked for the school district. So your family was pretty much, you know, embedded in the community. And you told me that you learned two things. One was your dad taught you work ethic. He was a guy who really kind of put his nose to the grindstone and really put his effort in.
Yeah, work ethic and life support, I guess, more than anything.
Yeah.
Like I said before, you know, we were never a wealthy family, but he was always able to put food on the plate and provide the things needed to play the sports and anything else in life that we needed support in as
Sure.
kids.
And your mom was always there to support you.
She was right beside him, yeah, the whole time. She never failed to show up either. She was more the silent type, but you know what? She was always there, and she would do anything for us kids as well growing up. So it was kind of nice to have that from both sides of the parents.
One thing that was important about this time in your life was that your dad initiated the process for getting status with Tsilhqot'in Nation. That was a big change in your lives.
Yeah, him and his siblings actually for years had been trying to acquire the status cards, and like I said, they had to get some paperwork to prove way back when that I don't exactly know what the hiccup was, but to show that my grandmother was not married to a Caucasian man at the time of their birth or something like that along those lines. It was but to find that paper took about, you know, in between 10 and 15 years for my uncles to track
My
that down.
God. Did it seem like it was a huge uphill battle, this process of proving to the government that this was totally legit?
Yeah, well, you know, I'd always been told that, you know, we had something in our bloodlines and that took us back a ways, and I actually never even realized that my uncles were working on it as long as they actually were. I just thought, you know, it kind of came to fruition that somebody decided to go forward with it, but they had actually been searching for quite a while, which I found out later on. So yeah, it was a fairly good process. I'm sure it's more taxing on them than it was myself because I didn't have to do that legwork of the side of things, right? But
You
yeah, no,
did.
we finally got what we needed and were able to go through the process there.
So what was it like when this long, complicated, sometimes ridiculously complicated process finally came to fruition and you finally had the whole family, right, status?
Yeah.
What?
Well, everybody on my dad's side has the status. My mom's side, doesn't have it.
Really?
So there was a time, I guess, but this is way, I think, years ago I think in 87 the laws changed. But if, you know, that would back then, if they would have gotten it, I think my mom could have got it just through being married to my father.
For
But they
sure.
changed those laws, and so yeah, nobody on my mom's side has it. It's just my father's side.
That's pretty hard to take, especially when you know that it's just a legal kind of impediment. It's got nothing to do with who you are and what you represent and what the world represents to you.
Yeah.
Did that moment, what kind of impact did it have on you when you sort of knew now for sure that you were a member of a community that goes back, as they say, to time immemorial, as opposed to, you know, the Johnny Come Lately settler community. You were actually part of the founders rather than
Yeah,
the
that's
run.
right. I don't know. It was kind of I don't really know how to explain that one. It was actually nice to have that validation that you know, they weren't just stories being passed around the family throughout the
Sure.
years.
Right.
I
Yeah.
guess would be the easiest way to put it.
Did like your dad and your uncles and stuff like that, did they connect? I mean, even though there was not this paper thing, did they connect to this Tilcotin community and interact with them and visit people out in the reserve and all that stuff? Was that kind of stuff going on?
No, well, my uncles and my aunts, none of them were in the Tsilhqot'in area except for my dad. I mean, over the years, a few of them did live there, actually. My uncle Jack and my uncle Doug, I do believe, lived there for a while. But no, I don't think they went out, you know, to the reserve so much.
Right.
But that being said, you know, they all look the part, as where you can see on the video. I'm blonde hair, blue eyed. I'm not quite fitting the realm of where I should, but yeah, it's now that I'm like, I, now that we have the cards, I've been out there to the reserve, to the 2C reserve where we're allocated from, I guess.
Right.
And toured around there and talked to the band and stuff. And, you know, it's just trying to, I guess, not so much recoup, but trying to learn a bit more about the community out that way. My grandfather, however, he was a conservation officer over the years named Jack McKill. And he's almost a legend. If you Google his name, some of the stories out there of the things that he did, you know, plays into that background for sure, but he was never, you know, I guess part of that community either. So
really, so he didn't have status either?
No, I don't think so. I think it came from my dad's mom's side, to be honest. Really? Like I said, there's the book that I have that from the Chilcotin, and it shows her and her mother, and she was probably 4 years old, and you know, she, I guess now would be close to 100 if she was still alive. So, you know, that's a fairly old picture kicking back then. So yeah, no, my grandfather's side is more the Scottish actually.
Uh-huh.
And then the Indigenous falls into my grandmother's side of the things.
Yeah. It's such a tangled mess, and so many laws and rules were set up to make it hard. I mean, if a woman married and left the reserve to a non-Indigenous person, she lost status. Just,
yeah,
you know, absolutely crazy. And if it was the other way around, no. I mean, it just didn't. I mean, it's not only misogyny, it's also, you know, just discrimination overall, period.
For sure it is, yeah. But, you know, that's, I guess, such is life, unfortunately. I can't sit here and talk about it on the radio, but if you just take a look around at the government these days, it's pretty self-explanatory in my mind.
Yeah, no, I think the role of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been huge in terms of bringing things forward, and now there is much more of a conversation, I mean, a real conversation about what indigeneity means and why it's important.
And, yeah, for sure.
And you were saying, we're listening to CBC, you can hear programs now that really present the genuine picture of life in the Indigenous world and how important it is to the rest of us, actually, you know, that we have to pay attention to. We have to learn lessons from the Indigenous world and worldview that we've forgotten and got crazy about.
Yeah, I'm not one of those ones that runs around, you know, kayaking and crying about the situation or trying to promote anything. I just, you know, I'm proud to be a part of the culture, but, you know, as for what happened in the past, there's, you know, there's nothing you can do about that, so.
Well, we're proud to have you on the show as far as that goes, so there we are. We're both
yeah,
proud.
Yeah, that works.
Maybe just before we move on, I'd like to mention you told me that you're looking to get status for your daughter. And that, and that's an important transition as well, to have kind of the whole line of your family included in the same community.
Yeah, for sure. So the way I see it, well, she deserves to have that card as well in life. But, you know, I'll get it for her now at the age of 10, because I've been going through life, she has the benefits of what it could bring to her life.
Sure.
I certainly wish I would have had it, the proof, when I was doing my trades, like my chef trade and my electrical trade. I mean, I could have had some help in school and stuff like that, right? It's not that that's what it's all about, but it's just kind of funny how I was saying before, you know, last time we spoke, that, you know, now that I have the card, I could have, you know, got some help with throughout schooling, but then going back and trying to get some, you know, reimbursement or whatever, it's like, well, no, you didn't have the card then, so I guess I wasn't Indigenous, you know, those years before. It just, now that I have the
weird
card, all of a sudden, it's really funny in that sense. But yeah, so I just figure, you know, she deserves it as well, and she'll be a very good part of the community as well. My buddy Frank Marchand, he like I said, I explained before, he carves canoes, and he's going to take her out on his next maiden voyage. Actually, he does it for the school districts around the Okanagan and Shuswap, and he's going to take her out as their, I guess, what do you call it? Their young representative, I guess, their child representative. So,
right.
You know, I try and get her involved in some things like that as well, just to learn a bit about the background of people and where they come from and where we come from. And
for sure,
I find it important to educate her on it as well.
Yeah, and now it's sort of out in the open and it's clear, and so there's you don't have to kind of say, well, it's sort of like this, but it's not really. Now you can say it really is. We are identified. We know who we are. We know who we are. So, in the absence of status and various other kinds of sports, you worked at about just everything you could possibly imagine for a number of years before you got into the food world. Car wash, highway crew, bridge crew. You took your athleticism into new dimensions with some of the work you're doing, sort of, you know, hard work, physical work, demanding work, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Swinging hammers is where it started. Actually, what I wanted to do coming out of high school was, I wanted to be a conservation officer and follow my grandfather's footsteps. I love the outdoors, and to me, that would have been a dream job. Mm. But, unfortunately, the counselors back then steered me away from that, told me that there was no demand for jobs out there.
Oh, dear.
So in my mind, that's a little crazy, because what are you going to do when all these guys that are working decide to retire if you're not going to build any new? So anyways, I wasn't able to get into that. So I started out with the construction trades, did all my work experience through there while I was working at the car wash. Mm-hmm. And then, just progressed into a few different things over the years. And then, like I said, I got laid off as the company I was working for as a bridge builder sold. And we were told to reapply for our jobs, and I didn't want to sit around and wait. So I inquired with my buddy's mom about the kitchen she worked in. She said they were looking for work, and I went the next day with a resume and walked out of there with a job. So that's kind of where my kitchen career started. It was kind of more of a fill-in and a paycheck than it was anything else.
A turning point in history. I mean, in personal history, it was really, look where you are today. I mean, it's been a path since that time into the world of food. Your boss liked the way you worked so much that offered you an apprenticeship. Went straight into it.
Yeah, my chef at the time, I think I was there for, I don't even think it was 6 months, right? 3 to 4 months or so. And he just said, you're really taking to it. You're doing well. He asked if I wanted to just start an apprenticeship. So that was... I didn't have any direction in life at that point, and I figured, well, 1920, it's time to start looking at something for a career, and I decided to take the apprenticeship. So that's where I started cooking full time, I guess, or seriously.
And this is serious. I mean, the program for a Red Seal is like years in the process, many thousands of hours. Why don't you just lay out the requirements of the program, because it's fairly demanding.
Yeah, I had to. I guess it's demanding in a sense. I guess it depends on who you are and how
you
look.
If you're a hard worker, it's nothing, right?
Yeah,
if you're a baseball player with a 91.
It's not that it wasn't something, but it was, I don't know. But we had to do, it was 1,500 hours a year. I think total accumulation was 6,000 hours before you could even get signed off on the as a ticketed person. We had to go to school, I think it was four different times at 8 weeks of every session, but we did that once a year. So you'd work for 10 months and then go to school for your few weeks a year and then come back to work.
And at the end of that process, you must have had a pretty good idea of what you do. How do you make food and bring it into the world, as it were, for other people to consume?
I did. Yeah. I had worked at a few different places by this point in time. I didn't work under the same chef as most chefs out there probably have not worked under the same chef their whole apprenticeship. It's good to see a variety of different things and different sides of the business, right? You could always work in one place, but really never learn much outside of that place. And you go to step somewhere else, and now you're in trouble. So it was good to go see a different plethora, I guess, of kitchens throughout my years as an apprentice. There was, I think, only actually three that I had worked at while I was apprenticing. And then after that, I kind of stuck with the one in Edmonton once I got there, because I didn't really need to go jump around anymore.
So the world of chefs is, I think the word that came up in our conversation was crazy. It's there's a certain crazy overtone to being a chef.
It can be, yeah. I still have a few buddies that play in the game in the restaurant world, and they'll tell you at the same time, it's definitely not for everybody. You almost have to be a little bit crazy to love that job. But there is a few of us out there that are like that. Obviously, there's many people out there that are in the game. And they probably would all attest to the same thing, saying that, not all of us are quite right in the head to keep doing it as long as we do.
So what do you have to have as a person to be a chef? What do you have to be able to deal with, and what
You need
qualities?
to have a good mental stability, I guess, and not I guess not so much take everything to heart that comes your way. There's people that get broken down just, well, I guess it's a little different out there nowadays, but when we were growing up in the kitchens, you got yelled at and things were thrown at you if you did something wrong. And
Oh, dear.
it's a bit of a crazy world out there. There's a lot of books you can read out there that'll tell you the exact same thing, if not worse. But yeah, there's it's not for everybody. You can't be faint of heart, and like I said, you just can't take things too personally, because a steak gets sent back. Well, somebody might get broken from that, where somebody else goes, "Well, I'm gonna do it better next time." And there's times where it's fairly daunting, and you're on that line, and the printer's going off for a few hours straight. Some people don't know where to go or what to do, and you have to be able to hold your composure, I guess, would be a good way to put it.
So your do you think, what do you think got you ready to do that? Because obviously you had a capacity to deal with that. What do you think helped you survive in that kind of crazy world?
My attitude growing up, and still to this day, is I've always just looked at life as, I don't care what other people think. And if you do that, it's not so much that I don't care what other people think. I just, if you dwell too much on what others think about you, then it really sets you back in life, and you're living to somebody else's life standards, not your own. So for me, it's like, oh well, the customer didn't like that. Meh, water off my back, right? Keep going. Let's move on. That's one customer out of 500. So it all depends on how you look at the whole situation as a whole.
Do you think that part of this had to do with being connected to the Indigenous world and all the things that have been done and have happened to Indigenous people in this part of the world? That it's not that it doesn't necessarily happen to you personally, but it's sort of out there as a kind of kind of this cloud hanging over, which you have to be tough to just deal with, right?
Yeah, I guess in a sense, but I don't really think that really had anything to do with that. I just, I've just always been fairly outgoing, and I've just really never looked at how other people look at me. And I find it funny when people do that. I just think that,
That's their
like I said,
problem.
you're looking and living to somebody else's life standard. You're not living your life. You're not living free. You're not doing your own thing. And I will never conform to somebody else's standards. And if somebody doesn't like what I'm doing, they don't have to come around me. I guess would be the easiest way to put it, right?
I think that's a sensible attitude. I think it's a very sensible attitude. All right, restaurants. You did every, like you said, you moved from one to another. It wasn't just one little setting. There's a pub restaurant in Williams Lake, a casino restaurant. Why don't you just rattle off some of the places you worked and what were they like? Because there was a lot of variety.
Well, the pubs and stuff where I started as a kid, I didn't know any better. They're a good place to start, though. I mean, they kind of teach you a few of the basics and a few of the craziness that happens. So I did the pub and opened the casino kitchen in Williams Lake, and then came down to the Okanagan area. I was in Vernon. Like I said, I worked at Earl's for almost 2 years, but that was a lifestyle choice, because I was managing the day crew there, and I knew once I stepped outside those doors, I would never get in that shift again in my life. If you're good in the chef world, you're there when it's busy, and you're there, at the busiest time. So you're always there late nights and weekends and all that stuff. You usually have Sunday, Mondays off. And, so I stuck with that schedule Monday to Friday, which it was quite nice to have for a little while. And then I worked at a few fine dining restaurants, some casual fine dining, and
Vernon Eclectic Med.
the Eclectic Med in Vernon. Yeah, they're a casual fine dining joint. They're still there till this day. Very good restaurants. Their food is phenomenal for the most
Intermezzo.
part. Intermezzo is also pretty good. Yeah, that's actually owned by the same owners as Earl's. I was working at Earl's at the time, and they had first bought that place. So I worked a few shifts over there just to kind of help them out at that point in time. So I had been there as well. I'd done the Vernon Golf and Country Club.
Yeah, you said about the Vernon Golf and Country. That's where cooks go to die.
You might make some people mad with that one, but in my mind, that's where chefs go to die for sure. His golf courses, that's an easy gig.
It's an easy gig. Well, that's where they
Yeah,
go. They go to retire before they retire.
it's really, I shouldn't say it's not always the easiest. That might make some chefs mad. There's some very good chefs that do work at golf courses, but they still have the higher end restaurants at those places. But like the lower end golf courses, if you're in that joint, the toughest thing about that I found was you have one golfer that doesn't like your fries, well, you got to change your fries for that one person because they're usually membership-owned courses. And you change the fries and piss six other people off. So where do you go, right? It's always it's a constant battle. It's just more of a headache, I think, at those places than anything. But then that being said, like I said, there is some very, very well-known chefs in the golf course world, but that's looking at like Predator Ridge and places like that that have some amazing restaurants and stuff in them. Also, I shouldn't say it's where chefs go to die, but the lower end golf courses
You can say whatever you like. Hey, what do you think is the reason why there's all this kind of, just to not cut too fine a point of, there's all this kind of abuse that goes on behind the scenes in the kitchens where the food is being fired through? Is it just because everybody's really tense, or is it because it's a tradition? You know, like some sports, people yell at each other, other sports, they don't, you know,
I think it's more just the intensity of the whole situation. You know, it's a stressful position. If you're in a chef position and, you're looking after 10, 15 guys cooking your food, you have to pay attention to what everybody's doing. And, you know, a lot of these places nowadays, their plates are so intricate that if you have one person slip up on that line, your whole plate is out to lunch or off timed or not ready to go when the rest of the table is. You know, and there's always servers in the back looking for food, and there's always that camaraderie between front of house and back of house, which shouldn't happen, but it does for sure. It's an interesting world for sure, to say the least.
You know, it's interesting. It's sort of a parallel with it being indigenous in the non-indigenous community, and also being in a restaurant in the front, eating the food, and not realizing that if you could go through that door into that other place where the food is being prepared, you'd see mayhem. Organized mayhem. But nevertheless,
some places you may not see what you want to see.
Exactly. I mean, it's almost like there's this hidden world that to do with food prep that's out of sight of the general public, but is, as you say, intense, kind of crazy, everything flying in all directions. It's kind of like two parts of the world that don't know each other very well. The people in the front are just sitting there casually having a good time, and you're busting yourself in the back room and a bunch of other people as well.
Sure. So they're, you know, servers still have to work hard as well. They're running around to multiple tables their thing. And realistically, one doesn't flow without the other.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's the servers out there that go around and stack their tables, and they'll send six back to the kitchen. Well, when the kitchen gets that order from that server, they look at that and go, okay, I'm going to slow everything down here, and you're going to get all six tables at the same time. Good luck running that out. You know what I mean? There's things like that that do happen for sure.
A little bit of gamesmanship going on here.
Always. But usually the chefs end up winning at those ones. There's.
Yeah, you got the food in hand to start off with.
Yeah, and sometimes that's not always the best way to look at things, but you know, you got to teach them a lesson as well. You got to teach them that without us, you guys ain't going to get your tips, and without you, we're not getting ours either.
So food preparation, you know, you're immersed in all this world. So you're off to Edmonton. You're about 25. That's where you start off at a golf course as a sous chef. And things kind of worked their way forward a little bit as time went by. I remember one place you were telling me about was the Executive Inn near the airport.
And, Executive Royal Inn, yeah.
And that was where different things started to happen. You met different kinds of people. You met a whole bunch of people in the Filipino community who work in food, and from them learned all sorts of things that were, you know, interesting and different. Talk about that a little bit.
I did, yes. That place, I had to say, would, like I said before, is a food factory, not so much a restaurant, but at the same time, it's a restaurant. The amount of food that went out of that place was unbelievable. And a lot of that was attested to the Filipino community in that kitchen. You know, I'd never worked in a place where they were heavy on the, you know, on the foreign worker programs. That place was definitely that. Made things tough at times. Like I spoke about before, the language barrier for some of them made things really hard. But
they had to work really hard in this world.
These guys come over and they work nonstop. Some of them worked at, well, we had two hotels. We had the Executive Royal Inn, and then down was the Executive Express down the street. We had both kitchens that we ran there. And some guys would work at both places. They'd work you know, night and day, some of them, and all they're doing is working to send their money back home. So it's a very, you know, commendable thing that they're doing. And I respected what they were doing, but I think they're crazy for doing it at the same time. But then again, that comes back to being crazy in the chef world, right?
Everybody's crazy at the same time, but for different reasons.
That's right.
You guys were, there was also competition, competitiveness. You mentioned something about gold plate.
Yeah, the gold plate cooking competition in Edmonton was held at the Expo Center. And I actually still have the menus and the hats, the chef hats and stuff that I had from that out in my bins in the shop. Just something I kept as memorabilia over the years. But it was a collaboration of, you know, all the top restaurants and hotels and everything throughout Edmonton. And we just went there and we had to cook a 4-course meal and people judged the food. And it was a pretty awesome place to go, actually.
How'd you guys
do?
Cool
to see things like that.
How'd you guys do?
We actually got the fourth. Well, we ended up being the number fourth out of the hotels. Hotel McDonald down there took number one, but they were always well-renowned down there. There's a few other places that got us out, but all in all, rated out of the whole city for busyness and food production, we came out number four.
Yeah, well, that's and then there's a fair number of hotels, and I'm sure in Edmonton, so they really love.
Oh, there's lots. Yeah. Some of them are actually really nice. Their restaurants are spectacular. So. Actually, not something people think about, you know, to go for a meal, but you'd be surprised at some of the restaurants, some of these hotels do have their food is pretty high end stuff for sure.
Yeah, and what we're talking about is taking food and turning it into something that's visually and in terms of taste and all that kind of stuff is the whole presentation. I mean, that's a whole art form in itself.
It is, to an extent. Now you got to look at things these days. Now these guys doing gastronomy and all this stuff is, you know, if there's a few guys out there that are, you know, giving you a scented pillow full of lavender smoke. So when you break this pillow, you smell it while you're eating your food. And it's just, it's crazy in my mind.
Now we're getting into the stratosphere. We're getting way
out
there.
These guys are chasing the idea of all senses working together, right? And, you know, they're not wrong. But to me, when I go to eat, I want a meal. I don't want a couple pieces of leaf on a plate with some good flavoring on something that's going to fill me up, right?
Solid. Yes, we're going to live through this, not just have a nice flavor in our mouth.
That's right.
Yeah. You talk a little bit about Ram. Ram was a guy you met. He was from the Philippines, sous chef initially.
Yeah, he was actually my sous chef for the hotel.
Yeah.
As the executive sous chef, I had a couple of my own underlings there. His name is actually Ramesis.
Okay.
This is his actual name. We just shortened it to Ram because it made life easier.
Move faster.
That guy, yeah, that's right. That guy, he was a crazy Filipino, that one. He, very nice guy, very grounded. You know, he was actually quite quiet until he got to know you or like you, I guess. He was like the Filipino version of the Caucasians there, you know. You get hit on hard until we see that you can do the work. And then at that point you fit in a little better and you may not take it quite as hard, but he was very quiet, but the guy worked unbelievably hard, to be honest. He was pretty impressive to watch and to work with, actually.
We used to
have competitions there. We used to do, I don't even know, thousands of turkey dinners at, you know, Thanksgiving or whatever. So we had this younger kid that worked in the kitchen, and he said he could bone out a turkey faster than we could. And we just kind of looked at each other and laughed. And
this is something.
So we said, okay, let's do this, right? So, you know, we had 300 turkeys to do for our banquets that day. So, of course, we let the kid win. And then we said, well, congratulations. Now you're so fast. Now you got the other 299 to do, right? So it's just one of those things where it comes back to the, you know, the games in the kitchen.
Did he get it?
Yeah, he understood that
he'd been
don't play
in.
Games anymore. Yeah, that's right. And then we showed him afterwards that he wasn't faster, but you know, he made the mistake of, you know, making that choice. So, but me and Ram, it's just funny. We'd stand across from each other. You know, we'd be prepping meatloaf for the line or whatever we were doing, and we'd always each have a scale, and we'd be, you know, balling it up in our hands and seeing how many in a row you could get to the perfect weight without putting it on the scale beforehand. And, you know, we just had fun stuff that we did like that. And he was just a really good guy to work with. And it was nice to get to know him over the years.
Yeah. And he's ended up staying in his country.
He did, yeah. He was working on his permanent residency when I was there. I think I spoke to him a few times after I left, and he had finally gotten it. But that's a process for those guys to go through too. I think they're there for, it's a 2 to 5 year process, I think, depending on what they're doing. Or
Same paperwork trail that you had to your family had to deal with. Different
yeah,
papers, but same idea.
exactly. So yeah, he left his kid back home and came over here, and like a lot of them did, left family back home and worked and sent their money back there to support their families and try and get them here at the end of the day was their end game.
And that's what he was able to do.
Yeah, there was a few of them there that went through the course while working at the hotel that were successful in making that happen. But
When you were watching people like this, I mean, they come to a different country, their command of the language is sometimes limited. They are not necessarily treated very well. I mean, they are expected to do a lot of hard work or else, they won't be accepted into the country sort of thing. It's an interest. I mean, in my mind, I'm just seeing an analogy between your family getting status, becoming part of a community that was really part of your community anyway, the human community, but also the part of the indigenous community. And here's this guy who comes over. He has to make real sacrifices, just as so many indigenous people had to do. And over time, by persistent and hard work, you finally climb that mountain and reach the top. I don't know. It just seems that there's a certain analogy there
for
between what
sure.
he'd had to do and what you've had to do and your family too.
But also seeing that side of the industry, a lot of those guys get abused because their employers or, whoever they're working for, they know that if they don't have that job, they ain't getting a permanent residency. And there's a lot of people that take advantage of that, which I 100% disagree with, but it's definitely out there, and I've seen it even through my days in the kitchen. These guys are just taking a beating sometimes, and there's times where I even had to step in and say, "Whoa, that's got to stop, right? Like that's not happening anymore." Just things like that. There's a whole different brigade of things that happen throughout life, but you just gotta take it as it comes, I guess. But for the most part, they're treated fairly well.
I think that overall all of us are starting to become more aware of the fact that it's not just what you do, it's how people relate to you and do they treat you fairly? Do they treat you with, and certainly the whole notion of social justice is starting to become part of the conversation. It's not just on the side, it's actually central.
Yeah,
And
that's right.
I
You
mean, go ahead,
you
sorry.
don't always need that language to communicate either. There was a point Ram and I would be working together on the line, and we'd have a 4 foot bill hanger that's full of bills, and the printer's rolling out and on the floor by another 8 feet. You got 1,000 people you're waiting to feed. He'd be working beside me, and I would turn around and plate steaks, and he's already got my veg and my side dishes and stuff on the plate without even speaking to one another. We just knew where we were, and we could just, we worked very well like that. So you don't always need that language barrier either. It's just about getting to know somebody and their work habits and how they flow, I guess.
Yeah, no, it is. It's sort of like being in a battlefield. You can't afford to spend a lot of time thinking about what you're doing. You have to get it down so pat that you know exactly what's coming next. Speaking of which,
That's right.
you were like I'm sure any really competent chef, you knew exactly where all your tools and utensils were. It was an important part of your shtick, as they say. Where the knife is, it's got to be there
Yeah.
each time.
I set up my line before the dinner rush hit every night, exactly the same. And there's a lot of us out there that do it. There's a lot of them. I'm sure there's still guys out there that do it to this day. But as far as even my towels, my tongs, my favorite tongs, my knives, everything was set exactly in the same spot, so I could probably close my eyes and cook that line without even having to think about it. I could just spin and grab whatever I wanted. I was the guy that would get pissed off if somebody actually took my rags and be like, where that did my rags go, kind of thing, right? One of those things where it doesn't throw you off, but it's one of those things where it slows you down, I think, in my mind. So as a chef, you have to be very on cue and set up for success in that sense. You have to set yourself up, otherwise you're starting behind the eight ball right off the get-go, and you'll never catch up on a dinner rush. You're just out to lunch the whole time.
And the pressure that
So it's
arrived.
about being organized, and without that organization, you have no luck. You're gonna need some luck on your side for sure.
That's right. And the pressure that is coming from the customers who are out there saying, I'm hungry, they don't necessarily see all of the work that's going on to preparing the food that comes out on the table. So
no, they don't see the other 350 people in front of them that have already ordered food, right? And that's what that hotel was all about. I mean, it's there was times where we had to tell the servers, you let your tables know, you know, you got a 50-minute food wait. Take them a free drink, take them a free side salad, take them, you know, whatever, give them a free dessert at the end of dinner, keep them happy, keep them there. But you have to be upfront with your customers and give them that choice. Otherwise, they're just going to end up pissed off at the end of the day and you're giving away a bunch of food, right? Mm-hmm. But if you are upfront and offer them a few things along the way to keep them there and keep them waiting and not, you know, most people are okay with it. There was the odd customer, obviously, that wasn't, and that's fine. But, you know, you do what you can to try and keep the customers happy for sure.
You're learning a lot about human nature, too, about the fact that, as you say, most people are reasonable, but there's one or two in the crowd who've got a bee in their bonnet. And I've heard other people talk about that in sort of the retail world in general, you know, where you're interfacing with the public. There's always somebody who's got, you know, a fly up their nose. And then there's the vast majority of people say, sure, whatever, you know.
I had a guy actually at that restaurant at the hotel. He was in the sports lounge and I can't remember. I think he didn't like his steak and the prawns that he had. He said they were overcooked or something. So this was on a Sunday night, Saturday night, I guess. My chef and the GM of the hotel were already in the sports lounge having a beer, so they couldn't do anything about it. So I had to go. This guy started storming down into the kitchen. The only ones left down there were Filipinos. I was just happened to be getting ready to leave. So I kind of got in front of him and stopped him from going into the kitchen because these guys don't need to hear that. Mm-hmm. Somebody rip it on them, some customer, and then in the first place, it's not their place to go there. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, asked him what his problem was, and he said, "Well, my steak was overcooked." And I said, "I checked the food before it went out; it was done correctly." I said, "Your prawns weren't even, you know, fully cooked through; they're a little opaque in the center, so they were still nice." And he's like, "Well, I have this camp, and I would do this, and I would do that." And I say, "That's great. I wouldn't eat at your restaurant, right?" Like. One of those things, and he asked my name, and I told him my name and told him I was the executive sous chef, and he said, "I'm going to put in a complaint." I said, "Go ahead, good luck." And he went to the front end, put in a complaint, and the GM of the hotel banned him, so he wasn't allowed back. I said, "How'd that work in your favor, right?" But there's those people out there that got to be put in their place at times, and it's just, I guess he was one of those customers that complained about everything, trying to get something for free or trying to get something for cheap, right? And he used to complain about the rooms all the time and everything, I guess, so he just said, "That's enough, you're not coming back here anymore."
It's wonderful, wonderful. You know, a story like that, I think, warms everybody's heart. It's sort of like the David and Goliath, except that the Goliath actually turns out to be not as powerful as he really thought he was.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Now, in addition, you were work in the crazy world of food prep and commercial food production. I said at the beginning of the listener's going to find out you're a bit of a dynamo, and the dynamo part was that while you're doing all this, you were also along the way looking to get qualified as an electrician, and in fact, you have your Red Seal qualification in that field as well.
Yeah, so what happened there was, you know, just over the years... Well, actually, I shouldn't say over the years. I still love cooking till this day. But, you know, I had a daughter come into my life 10 years ago now at this point. And just working in the chef world with a kid, I began to realize real quick that that wasn't where I wanted to be. I was not it wasn't the family life. I wasn't giving my child the attention she needed. And I was missing a lot of her life, which I wasn't okay with. So I ended up... going into electrical and, you know, changed my schedule completely where I was working Monday to Thursday, 10-hour shifts, and I was home on the weekends, Friday, Saturday, Sundays every week. So that just made, you know, the most sense in my mind to try that out. And, yeah, I went through the apprenticeship on that one too, and now I'm a ticketed electrician as well.
So did you have to do the same kind of hours for that training program?
I did, yeah. The hours are the same. It's ended up being 6,000 hours to complete. It was 4 years, that course, and 10 weeks every year. So we work for, I guess, you know, 8, 7.5 months and go to school for the other 2.5 every year. I did that for 4 years consecutively and finished that a couple of years ago now.
That's, I think anybody listening to the show is going to say, they're going to be scratching their head, how the heck did he do all that?
Is it you'd be surprised. There's actually, I know of a few chefs that have left the chef world and gone to the electrical side of things. It's kind of funny, you know, it's, you know, there's a lot of people in the construction world that say the chefs or the electricians are, you know, the princesses of the construction world, but I challenge anybody to that face-to-face for sure.
Well, I think you've got the street cred to prove it as well. Your daughter's birth, that changed things for you. Wanting to get
in a positive way for sure.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Getting out of this mad, crazy world where also you're doing other people's work. You're not determining how you want to structure your life. Somebody else tells you this is how we do it, and that's the way it is. And that's been the impetus for getting into your own food business. And I think along the line you had some back problems that also you know, that's the kind of stuff that makes everybody start to think, you know, what am I doing? I don't want to keep this up, and my body is telling me this isn't a good idea. So all these things kind of came together, it seems to me, to kind of move you into a sort of a different way of doing things, and that's where you're heading now. What's that direction overall, and what are you doing there?
Well, I am still employed by my employer as an electrician. I'm just under the long-term disability, trying to get my back figured out at the moment. Mm-hmm. So I'm, you know, utilizing that time to try and get some things rolling in the food world as well. This is where, you know, now the canned products come into play. I'm going after some wholesale things. I got a few stores that have my products, and just being able to play with food still on my own terms rather than, you know, working for other people in the restaurant industry, you're still kind of handcuffed to a certain extent. But being out on your own, doing your own thing in the food world is a lot more fun in my mind. And it's, you know, not quite, it's demanding, but it's not quite there where you need to be there night and day and weekends and all that stuff. You're still able to get time for yourself. So it's been nice. I still have to be careful what I do. I mean, I'm on a disability right now. I'm not doing anything that's going to impede that at all. But, you know, I am trying to move forward a little bit with some of my own stuff on the side for sure.
So you're producing a line of food products for consignment distribution in the community. Why don't you just outline the kind of stuff that you're producing?
Well, I do a lot of pickled products and some preserves as well. We have I got anything from pickled onions. Pickled garlic actually is one of my popular ones that flies out the door at the market usually. I have barbecue sauce. I got spicy pickled beans. I got pickled carrots, beets. And I'll be getting into asparagus, I think, this summer. Once the local stuff starts coming up, we have some of our own on the farm as well. And we do try to utilize a lot of our own products throughout the summer months. And then, you know, comes a time where we run out of stock and have to outsource at that point, but we do everything as much as we can off of the farm. And then I also have honey. We have bees here. We got, like I said, we have jams. It's just endless, and we're always playing with new things. It's never not really locked down to any certain thing, but like to be able to have that, the option of doing whatever I want, really.
So talk a little bit about your farm. It's a very busy place. Where is it, and how much land do you have available to you, and what are you growing there?
It is by Gardam Lake on the hill down into Enderby there. It's called Dark Horse Farms. It's actually my girlfriend's farm, so we together out here. We have chickens out here. We have now added turkeys. We have cows. We're going to get into a few pigs here and there. And then the mainstay for this farm is an equestrian facility. That's my girlfriend's game. She plays with horses, and too many crazy women in that world for me. So I stay away from that, stay on the food side of things. But I'm sure there might be some women from the, because she has a lot of horse borders and stuff. There may be some people that hear this interview, but I just stay away from the horses. That's not my game. I like the horses. They're very nice. I stop and talk to them and pet them and stuff when I'm walking by, but you know, to play in that realm, that's just not my gig. So sure. I try and stay on the food side of things, away from all that.
Well,
that
she's probably happy with that too, because I'm sure the meals at your place are pretty good.
Oh, well, I go watch and support whatever she's riding. They actually, most of them ride in dressage. I don't know if you know what that is, but it's, the horses are
very organized. It's very organized.
It's for the regular person to walk by, I might go, what the hell's going on? I didn't even know what it was until I met Jessica, to be honest with you. But just watching it over the time I have been around, is it's very impressive, and it takes a lot of skill and patience. So good on them for doing that. But like I said, I stay away from that as much as possible. We just had a clinic here this weekend. I didn't even go down to the arena.
You knew it was, it might be just as crazy as working in a kitchen. A lot of work.
Oh, yeah. Well, we had the first day, well, actually 2 days before the clinic even started, we had a lady pull in here with her horse trailer, and she basically ran through a gate, pretty much ripped down a gate, busted through a fence, backing up. Like, that's just stuff I don't need to get into. I had to go fix, me and Jessica had to go fix the fences and stuff. But if I was standing there when that happened, I might add a few choice words that probably shouldn't have come out of my mouth. So I try and save her that hassle also.
Your big project coming up is your food truck. And we need to talk about that, because that's something that's just sort of in the process of taking off. I learned something from you that I never knew, and you can shrink wrap a truck.
Now, essentially, that's what it is. Anybody, it's a graph. Anybody that's got graphics on their work vehicles, it's usually a body wrap of the vehicle. There's a lot of people that do it instead of a paint job. It's a cheaper way to go, and the product comes out looking amazing, to be honest. And if you get tired of the color, you can always get out your heat gun and peel it off at the end of the day. But yes, the truck is going in for a full body wrap with Spectrum Signworks out of Salmon Arm. They've been pretty amazing to work with. It goes in on the 21st, actually, of this month, next Thursday, or this Thursday coming up now.
And what's it going to say in the side of the truck?
What's the name? It's going to have Chilcotin Products. Chilcotin Barbecue is going to be the name on the truck.
Right, right.
So, we're going to do a lot of barbecue street fair style food.
And what kind of a vehicle is it? Obviously, it's a vehicle with some special attributes.
I've been working on peeling off the old vinyl that's on it, so they have a fresh start underneath, and it's an old Purelator van, actually. It's 24 feet long, but it's a full kitchen setup inside. I have fridges, freezers, prep areas, grills, deep fryers, flat tops, burners, anything that I need to do any type of food that I would have done in any commercial kitchen.
You're making me hungry. You're making me hungry.
And a lot of it's going to be done with smokers as well. So there's that side of things as well.
So what kind of stuff will you be distributing and selling from your van? You got an open side, right? An open side that opens up with a...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a food pass window in there for sure. And the awning kind of, lifts up above the door. And then you got the food pass window there. People order and collect their food there, just like any food truck.
Right.
But as far as menu, I'm going to be fairly versatile. I'm not going to set a menu in stone. I don't want to be to limit myself in that sense. I'm going to constantly be changing things and constantly putting out new products. So, it's going to be in the barbecue realm, but that's not going to be all I do. And I don't want to promise anybody anything, because that's, like I said, I don't want to handcuff myself. But if there's, popular products and whatnot, I'll keep them around more often or bring them back more often. But I do want to play with food in this food truck for sure.
And the meat products are going to be meat from your own property.
So, yeah, we are
fresh.
That's the other thing that's written on the side of the truck. Promoting it's farm to plate street food is my business motto. That's the whole purpose of, a lot of the chickens that we have here and the turkeys and the beef and the pork that we're going to be getting is I want to give people that true farm to plate eating experience, where everything that's served out of that truck is grown on this farm.
Which is absolutely central in terms of what we're calling food sovereignty. You not only have the food from here, but also the quality, exactly what's in it. And
that's right.
A lot of people don't like that.
No. And I don't know. It's all about... local these days, and sitting through this COVID crap over the last 2 years here has just really opened a person's eyes and, put some ideas in my head. And it's, to me, a farm to plate food truck is going to be pretty awesome, to be honest.
Yeah, I think the idea is brilliant. We talked about a list of places that you've been looking at where you could set up, and it's just everybody around town, the IPE, Roots and Blues, O'Keefe Ranch, DeMille's, Williams Lake Stampede, possible wineries, powwows, and I'm pleased to say that I came across another place that you could go to, which is the parking lot of the Shushrop Family Center, in a conversation with the executive director the other day.
So yeah, as long as it's their parking lot, I can do that. Once I have the business permit for Salmon Arm, there are some stipulations where you know, I can go to, I just need, they're okay to be able to sit on their property, and then it's not a big deal. But there's also a side of things where they need, she was telling the business lady was telling me that you need to have, you know, they got to have like a food vendor permit or something. So I said, what if somebody has, say for instance, a vehicle dealership is having a sale and they want the food truck there. She goes, well, you fall under their special events permit. Okay, so does somebody have to have a special events permit for me to be able to sit on their property, even though it's their own property? That doesn't make any sense to me. So I just need their permission and I'll go do it. And if I get in trouble, I'll learn from that.
Garrett, it's been an absolute delight having you on the show. I think everybody can see that you're the dynamo I said you were, and I think everybody is going to join me and wish you the best of luck in your new venture with a food truck. And if we see it around, we're going to be running over and stopping at that window and picking up a pickle if we can't get fresh meat, or going to the stores and pick them up as well. I really am grateful to have you on the show. Thank you very much. And we're going to come back and talk to you again someday about the food truck when it's up and running and the shrink wrap is dried and you're out in the community doing your thing. Thank you very much.
Sounds good.
We look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks for having me on, and I look forward to the next conversation.
It'll be great. Thank you.